Okay, hello. I was waiting to see if Dove would pick up. There he goes. Waiting for him to either tell me to go or him to pick up. So anyway, here I am. back from a family vacation. That's where I've been in the last week. Jasmine and Ron and I went on a little loop. First, we went south a little bit in Colorado, southwest over to Durango. There's a train ride over there that Ron wanted to take, so we took that train ride. And then the next day, the second day of our vacation, we went to Mesa Verde. You can hear me, correct, Dove? That's what your yes means. You hear me? Yes, there is sound. Okay, good. we went to Mesa Verde, which is a place where the Native Americans, the Anasazi, I believe is the name of the Indians that live there, lived in cliff dwellings called pueblos. And there's a lot of these pueblos that are still well preserved. And we went and looked at them, but what was really interesting was most of them you can't really go in. You know, you just kind of stand behind a rope and look at it. But there was this one room underground that they would let you climb down into. And so I climbed down into this room. And as soon as my feet touched the ground in this room, I was overcome by stillness. and it's funny because there were actually a lot of tourists down there, people snapping pictures, people talking, you know. But I was overcome by this stillness, and I just stood there against the wall, embracing the stillness. And I did get a moment where, you know, a bunch of tourists had left, and no more tourists had come in, and I was alone in that room. And I just really enjoyed it. I could have stayed there all day, except that I knew that I was with Jasmine and Ron, and, you know, they, of course, wanted to go on. So I only spent about 10 minutes in the hole. But when I came out of the hole, Ron had been reading about it, and he told me that that was, of course, a spiritual place, that that was the spiritual center of the village, which I'm sure is absolutely what I felt down there. In fact, I said, when I came out of there, if they had told me it had any other purpose, like it's where they kept their potatoes cold, I would have said, I think you're wrong, because the energy was so strong down there. So that was really a magnificent experience, and I would love to go back there. Sometime maybe with other people who want to just sit in the hole for a bit. We also took a lovely hike there. And then we went on to Moab, Utah, where we did some horseback riding, hiking, four-wheeling. We really loved Moab as well. Moab is very, very beautiful. And in fact, Ron is all excited. He wants to go back there again next year for spring break. So I'm sure that, you know, if everything goes normally, we probably will. I usually go wherever Jasmine and Ron want to go for our family vacations, but it was a lovely place. So we're back home now and getting back into the groove of normal. And it's wonderful to be back here teaching. Tonight we're going to be looking at the 7 steps to awakening, beginning with quote number 120. And what I can do is give you a link to my journaling of quote number 120. There it is. And before we go and look at number 120, we're just going to take a little silence break. We'll all mentally go into the hole. So why don't we just take a few moments of silence, which I will end with amen. All right, let's begin. Amen. All right. So as I usually do with the Seven Steps to Awakening, I'm going to begin by reading from the book, the quote. And it seems to me, I remember we finished the Nisargadatta quotes for step one, so we're hanging out with some other master now. Let's see who we have here. Oh, we're going to begin someone called the Supreme Yoga. I don't know who that is. Maybe later, if I think about it, I'll look it up and get some information. But the name is the Supreme Yoga, and Bill Free has entered the room, so I will give the link one more time. And I'm going to read again on page 34, The Seven Steps to Awakening, quote number 120 by the Supreme Yoga. The fool, you know, he's talking about all of us when he says that, right? He's talking about a part of our mind. He's not talking about some individuals. He's talking about a part of our mind. The fool asks irrelevant questions irreverently. And the greater fool, the greater fool, again, he's talking about all of us, is he who spurns the sage's wisdom. He is surely not a sage who responds to the vain questions of a foolish questioner. Of course, I remember reading about Ramana Maharshi, how people would come and ask questions and he didn't answer everyone. Often he just remained silent. And when I was first reading about Ramana Maharshi, I thought, you know, with my foolish judgment mind, I thought that, you know, he was being a little rude. These people were coming, you know, suffering in one way or another and sincerely asking their questions, and they didn't know any better, and he was not responding. But as I grew in understanding myself, I came to realize that to respond to some questions, and not just questions, to respond to some stories when people tell you their stories, to respond at all is to breathe life into the illusion. And that's not helpful to anyone. So sometimes what is clearly most helpful is simply not to respond. And I have learned the art of not responding. And the people that are around me the most, I think, are becoming accustomed to that. It also reminds me of The Peaceful Warrior, which many of you guys have seen, where Socrates told Dan Millman that he needed to learn to ask better questions, right? He didn't respond to the questions he was asking at that point, other than to say, you need to learn to ask better questions. So again, the Supreme Yoga says, the fool asks irrelevant questions irreverently, and the greater fool is he who spurns the sage's wisdom. He is surely not a sage who responds to the vain questions of a foolish questioner. All right. So if we go ahead and look at the journal then, we'll see what I wrote after contemplating this quote. I wrote, the idea I am a teacher or I am a helper is not only a false idea about who I am, but when taken too seriously, it is a trap. It can lead me to disregard inner wisdom that guides do not help or do not respond by getting involved through a sense of responsibility or attachment to the idea it is my duty to help or it is my job to respond. And in fact, you can see that I used to project that identity thought onto Ramana Maharshi when I thought that he was being a little rude by not responding to people who came with what for them was a sincere question, right? I was projecting that idea that it was his duty to help, or it was his job to respond unto him at that time. Do not identify with any idea of who I am or what I am to do. Like a puppet, this is very important to me. Like a puppet, take on no identification based on movement. Simply move when the strings are pulled and do not move when they are not. So if we identify with the idea that we are, you know, the teacher, or that we are the helper, or that we are the the senior brother, you know, the person who's been with the course or some other study longer, and that there are people around us who are junior to us who may need understanding. Sometimes we take these ideas on as a part of our identity without noticing. And then what happens when someone asks a question or someone comes to us presenting a problem, there's a sense of responsibility, or at least that's how I experienced it. Someone else may experience it differently. But it's something other than guidance. It might be even a desire to appear right, right? That would be another possibility, and I'm sure there are others as well. But in my case, there was a sense of responsibility to try and help. And I will tell you that I got myself into hot water more than once when I really did have guidance that was just telling me not to respond, and I was not yet in a place where I could hear that guidance, because I was stuck listening to that ego idea that it was my duty to try and help, that that's what was expected of me, and that that's what I needed to do. I have since learned not to respond. And maybe it's not always understood, just like I didn't understand at one time when Ramana Maharshi was not responding. But that doesn't matter. Whether it's understood or not is not the point. The point is, you all, I think, know that A Course in Miracles says a miracle worker's only responsibility is to accept the atonement for herself. Actually, the Course says himself, but when I apply it to me, I say herself. And what that means is that my job, or at least what that means to me, is that my job is to get better and better and better, always get better and better and better at following my guidance. And so what happens is that there's a sharpening that occurs, and there's more and more clarity on the difference between ego and guidance. And so as this clarity has come about this idea that the sense of responsibility to respond, the sense of responsibility to help is actually ego, and that that little prompt to not respond, to not answer, to not add to this story with a response, is actually spirit, I have become much more comfortable not responding. So that's that. That's that. So I'll just read 120 again, and then we'll go on to 121. The idea, I am a teacher or I am a helper, is not only a false idea about who I am, but when taken too seriously, it is a trap. It can lead me to disregard inner wisdom that guides do not help or do not respond by getting involved through a sense of responsibility or attachment to the idea, it is my duty to help or it is my job to respond. Do not identify with any idea of who I am or what I am to do. I mentioned that this second part was very important to me. You know, one thing that the ego likes to do is make rules, because then we follow the rules instead of checking for guidance in the current moment. So what the ego would probably do with number 120 is swing all the way to the other end and say something like, you know, I never respond. And then guidance isn't checked for in the moment. So what this second paragraph is saying to me when it says, like a puppet, take on no identification based on movement. What this is saying to me is if there is a prompt to respond, if there is a prompt to give an answer, to do that, but not slip back into identifying with I am the teacher or I am the helper. Just, you know, do it and then let go. Because if you think of a puppet, the puppet has no sense of identification. The puppet just does, you know, whatever it does based on the strings that are being pulled. So do not identify with any idea of who I am or what I am to do. Do not identify with I am helper. Do not identify with I do not respond. Do not identify with either side of that coin. Like a puppet, take on no identification based on movement. Simply move when the strings are pulled and do not move when they are not. Very simple. All right, so if we scroll down, for those of you who don't have the link, I'll give it to you in a moment. If you scroll down and to the left, you will see number 121A. You can click on that to go to the next journal entry. And for those of you who are not in the journal yet and would like to be, I am going to provide a link in the room now. There we go. And there's actually a 121A and a 121B because as I contemplated the Supreme Yoga's quote, number 121, two thoughts came to me that were, I'm going to say, independent or strong enough on their own that it just felt better to write them out as two thoughts instead of trying to cram them into one. So first, let's look at what the Supreme Yoga said at 121. This is on page 34 of the Seven Steps to Awakening. One should positively strive to enthrone wisdom in one's heart, for the mind is unsteady like a monkey, and one should then avoid unwise company. Maybe it was because of the and. We'll see. Maybe that's why I felt to do an A and a B. Again, one should positively strive to enthrone wisdom in one's heart, for the mind is unsteady like a monkey, and one should then avoid unwise company. So let's start by looking at 121A. Listen within, with intense love, like an eager dog who watches its master intently for some sign of guidance. The funny thing is, the reason I laughed is that Jamie is laying here beside me right now, just staring up at me with those eyes. Anybody who has a dog knows those eyes, like she's waiting for some sign of you know, me giving her some attention, maybe go eat or, you know, go for the W thing or something like that. And I almost commented on you guys, like, oh, you should see Jamie laying here staring at me, but I did, then I chose not to. Chose not to say anything, and then this is what 121A is. So maybe the thought to comment on how she was staring at me was actually a prompt because she's doing that right now. Listen within with intense love, like an eager dog who watches its master intently for some sign of guidance, as Jamie is in this moment. The heart is master, not the mind. Do not be led astray by the imposter acting as master. Like the dog knows the smell and call of its master, know the smell and call of yours. So again, anyone who knows a dog probably understands why this symbol came to my mind. You know that look your dog has when your dog is just waiting for some sign from you that something's going to happen. And we want to wait with that same intensity, right? That same intense love for what we call in the Course community Holy Spirit, or what is called here for the heart to speak, to provide guidance. We want to be waiting with that same intensity. But what this also implies is that the mind may try to fill that spot. The mind, not may try, the mind will try to fill that spot. The mind will try to provide guidance for us, tell us what to do, what to say, how to react, what to think, what to feel. And what this is saying is that we really need to be as bright as a dog. A dog knows the difference between that which is its master and that which is not its master. And the dog waits for some sign from its master of guidance. The dog does not pay attention to the strangers going by. So we do not want to be fooled by the stranger in our head, the mind. One thing that I have learned, and I'm still learning, is the difference between what I now call myself and the mind. Obviously, before, I would have thought that the mind was me. But I'm now learning the difference between what I call myself and the mind. You know, the mind may have some great idea for how I should respond to someone. And the heart, at the exact same time, may be saying, you know, do nothing. And I'm learning to listen to the heart. And that's what this is really saying. It's saying, you know, stay focused within on that which you really are, on that guidance that's coming from the true self instead of from the imposter self. And it doesn't matter how excited the imposter self gets. It doesn't matter how much of a story the imposter self spins. You know, be like Hachi. Have you guys seen that movie, Hachi? Oh, my God. I don't know whether to tell you to watch it or not. I tell you what, that movie got me big time. I cried and cried and cried. I watched it with Zoe and Devin, and they cried and cried and cried, you know, for a long time. And then even the next several days when I was telling people about the movie, as I would tell them about the movie, I would start crying. So it really got to me. But for those of you who have not seen the movie, basically there is a dog named Hachi who has a master that he's very much in love with. And he goes to the train station every day with his master, and his master goes off to work. Hachi goes off and has his day. But in the evening, he knows when the master's train is returning, and he goes to the train station, waits for the master outside the train station. They walk home together every day. Only one day the master goes to work and he has a stroke or something and he dies and he never comes home. And Hachi sits outside the train station for 10 years until he dies. Now, this was a dog, you know, other people of course fed him. People tried to take him home. Relatives tried to take him home. He would just run away and return to the train station. He was intent on listening for his master, and he would not listen to anyone else. And finally, you know, everyone just surrendered to Hachi's wishes. But we'd really want to be like Hachi, listening intently for the heart, for its guidance, and not being fooled by the monkey mind. Hachi is a great symbol of knowing our master and waiting only for it. All right, so let's scroll on down. And to the left, you'll see a 121B. You can click on that. For those of you who are new to the room, I am going to share a link with you, which you can click on if you want to join us. Yeah, devotion, Barb has typed into the room. Perfect devotion. Hachi. Although he made me cry like a baby. He was a great symbol. Perfect devotion. Okay, 121B says, quiet attention for the guidance of the heart can be forgotten in the company of those who do not listen intently for the call of theirs. In order to be fully attentive, lose interest in distractions. Be devoted, focused, listening for the heart. Of course, this is what everyone wanted Hachi to do. They wanted him to forget his master because it caused them pain to see him sitting outside the train station for 10 years. But again, he was the symbol of not leaving that spot and being devoted. And we need to learn to not leave that spot. And at first, not leaving that spot may be more literal than later. At first, we may need to spend a lot of time alone, in quiet, with people who maybe have the same purpose as us. Because we may find that if we run off with, I'm going to say our old friends, for lack of a better symbol, and get involved in our old ways of playing and entertaining ourselves, we may find that we go long periods of time without remembering to listen for our true master, our heart. You know, people, you know, start talking about something and we just jump right in with them, totally being the old imposter self again. And so there may be a training time, a training period, where we really do need to spend a lot more time alone or a lot more time with people who are very focused inwardly while we become in tune and used to that new habit. Now, at some point, the habit may be so firm that we can then move about anywhere and it's not lost. And that's wonderful. But we just need to be honest with ourselves about what is truly in my best interest if I want to become one who, like Hachi, is totally devoted to the heart. Then is it in my best interest to be going here and there with those people? God love them, but or do I forget when I'm with them? And is it in my best interest to spend more time quietly alone for now? And each one can follow their own guidance. But that's what this is about. Quiet attention, for the guidance of the heart can be forgotten in the company of those who do not listen intently for the call of theirs. In order to be fully attentive, lose interest in distractions. Be devoted, focused, listening for the heart. All right, we can scroll down and to the left and click on number 122. I don't think anyone new has entered the room, but I will go ahead and post the link again. And I will read from the Seven Steps to Awakening, page 34. The one being quoted is the Supreme Yoga. And as I mentioned before, I do not know who that is. It's our one clear voice. That's obvious. But I don't know the story surrounding this seeming individual. But here is quote number 122. Only he would wish to hear this who is ripe for liberation. Okay, so referring to his own teaching, and I believe we can expand that to all of the teaching from all of the teachers in the Seven Steps to Awakening. Only he would wish to hear this who is ripe for liberation. And there are teachings that if we do not truly crave awakening, that we simply are not interested in. The teachings seem to go against what we want. Why don't we look at number 122 in the journal? These words are not for everyone. For the one still attached to the person as self, these words may be offensive or foolish. But for the heart that seeks detachment from the person, these words are sweet. Firm, yes. But to the heart that seeks detachment, firm is sweet. And maybe some of you know what I'm talking about. There is a time when, you know, if we're listening to a teaching, for example, that's saying, it might not be in your best interest to go with your friends and do the things you like to do. That sounds like a sacrifice. And if it sounds like a sacrifice, the reason for that is simply we are still attached to the person as self. We're still attached to the person's desires, the person's fears, the person's dreams, the person's hopes as who I am. And the idea that following those dreams and those hopes and those desires might not be in my best interest sounds like a sacrifice. But there does come a turning point. There comes a turning point when we are realizing our truer desire, which is to detach from the idea that I am this person. And as we are realizing that truer desire, we know that in order to detach from this person, I also want to detach from the ideas of the person, the preferences, the desires, the hopes, the dreams. And any teaching that is helping me to detach, any teaching that is helping to wake me up, is loved. So when a teaching comes that says, for example, it may be in your best interest not to go with your friends and do those things you like to do, you may need to spend more time alone now, that's received in love and gratitude. It's all a matter of readiness, I suppose. But there's no sense of sacrifice in it. If the purpose is to detach from the person as self, we are very grateful for every teaching that helps towards that purpose. So these words are not for everyone. For the one still attached to the person as self, these words may be offensive or foolish. But for the heart that seeks detachment from the person, these words are sweet. Firm, yes, but to the heart that seeks detachment, firm is sweet. All right, let's scroll down and to the left, and we can click on 123. And I will paste the link in the room. And the Supreme Yoga, in the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, says, even as the ocean is the substratum of all the waves, direct experience is the basis for all proofs, the direct experience of truth as it is. So he's not encouraging belief. He does seem to encourage practice, you know, such as the idea of, you know, avoiding unwise company. That's a practice. But he seems to imply that through practice, direct experience will come as the true teacher. We do not need to rely on belief. Even as the ocean is the substratum of all the waves, direct experience is the basis for all proofs, the direct experience of truth as it is, which Nikki has typed into the room. So if we read the journal then at 123, I wrote, ask the heart for direct experience of self. Ask the heart to show you all obstacles to this direct experience. Ask the heart to show you your part in removing these obstacles. Follow the heart's guidance. Do your part and trust the heart to do its part. And if you prefer a different language, you could say, ask the Holy Spirit for direct experience of self, right? Ask the Holy Spirit to show you all obstacles to this direct experience. Or If you prefer a different language, you could say, ask Jesus to show you your part in removing these obstacles. Follow Jesus' guidance. Do your part and trust Jesus or the Holy Spirit to do its part. Or you could say, ask the universe for direct experience of self. Or ask God to show you all the obstacles to this direct experience. Or even ask Ramana to show you your part in removing these obstacles. The symbol is not important. It's that wordless sincerity intent. That wordless sincerity intent. That's like a new word I just made up. Sincerity intent. You can hyphenate that in your minds. It's that which matters. By being willing to let go of whatever stands in the way of direct experience, by being willing to have it revealed to you, have it so that you see what your habits are that are an obstacle to direct experience. And then by being willing to surrender those habits, either immediately or through practice if the habits are more ingrained, but to surrender those habits so they are no longer a part of your practice. Because we're always practicing something. We're either practicing to maintain the idea of the little self, or we're practicing to release that idea. So the sincerity intent of asking, and the sincerity intent of being willing to see, and the sincerity intent of being willing to then allow those habits to change, or to change those habits through practice, that's what matters, not the symbol. Ask the heart for direct experience of self. Ask the heart to show you all obstacles to this direct experience. All obstacles. Ask the heart to show you your part in removing these obstacles. What do you need to do? Follow the heart's guidance. Do your part and trust the heart to do its part. All right, we can scroll down and to the left again and click on number 124. Once again, I will post this link in the room. We may have had a new person, I think. Here's a link to the journal. Before reading from the journal, I want to read the Supreme Yoga, quote number 124 in the Seven Steps to Awakening. We're under step one. The Supreme Yoga said, consciousness is pure. Thought is subject to confusion. I like that very much. It's very true. Some people who think of consciousness as being the same as thinking, because that term is sometimes used synonymously, may want to hear awareness is pure. That may be more clear. Awareness is pure. Thought is subject to confusion. So let's look at the journal. Number 124. I wrote, clarity can be gained or lost. Confusion comes and goes. Therefore, what I am is neither clarity or confusion. I am that which is constant, that which is present for all states of mind, before all states and beyond all states. Observe the mind's attachment to preferred states. observe the mind's resistance to states that are not preferred. What observes these states? What observes attachment or resistance to these states? What observes the state of observing? What is constant, always present? What am I? It seems like I remember particularly as a phase during the time when I was with Laurent. There would be a time, you know, typically when listening to Holy Spirit and writing the messages that came when we were together, great clarity would come. And I would feel so clear on something, some point of why something was a grievance maybe, or why something was an error thought in my mind maybe, or how believing error thoughts resulted in more error thoughts. You know, something would be so clear, crystal clear. And then I remember, you know, 20 minutes later or a day later or a week later, that same point that I experienced such clarity on would be so muddled and I would be so confused. It was like I never understood it in the first place. Like, where did the clarity go? And I remember distinctly loving the state of clarity and not loving the state of confusion. And that's what's being pointed back to when it says in this particular writing, observe the mind's attachment to preferred states. You know, we like to feel clear. We like to understand. We like to feel happy. We like to feel like we love everyone. You know, when those feelings come over us, when that's our present experience, we love that. We love to be at peace. We love those preferred states. But then it also says, observe the mind's resistance to states that are not preferred. When something happens and a grievance returns, I don't like that so much. When some point I was clear on becomes confused again and my mind is foggy again, I don't like that so much. When I'm annoyed by something, I don't like that so much. I'm afraid, I don't like that so much, right? This says, observe the mind's attachment. Observe, what is it that likes the clarity and doesn't like the confusion? What is it that likes when I'm feeling all peaceful and I can love everyone easily? And what is it that doesn't like it when a grievance appears or an annoyance appears? What is it that's attached to one state of mind and resists another state of mind? And what is it that can observe this? What is it that can observe the attachment? Can step back and see it? What is it that can observe the resistance? And if you've gone far enough, then you know that there's even something that observes that observer. What am I? That's the question on the table. I used to love to identify with the state of clarity because it was a preferred state. And in fact, I loved to identify with the state of clarity so much that I actually thought ongoing state of clarity was the goal. And then I met a friend, a dear friend now who lives in India. We call him Anatta. Sometimes I call him Tapan. I go back and forth. But he's the one that pointed out to me my identification with the state of clarity. And he was the one that pointed out to me that what I am is beyond that state of clarity, that the state of clarity is simply a temporary state. And when he pointed out to me in Facebook, in a Facebook conversation of all places. I saw it clearly. I had clarity on that. I never lost that. In that moment, clarity ceased to be the goal. Clarity comes, and in fact, there's been great clarity since then. Clarity is even a more constant state since then. But it's still a state. It wasn't always here, right? What am I? What is always present? What is always present in, we could say, for lack of better words, everyone, regardless of whether they seem to have clarity or seem to be the appearance of complete insanity. What is always present? Let's scroll down and to the left and click on number 125. And again, I will post the link in the room. I do think I see another new person. Oh, and I see Rosie asked, is clarity equal to consciousness? Well, words, you know, words can be used a thousand ways. But in the way I'm using clarity here, it means understanding. It means understanding instead of confusion. They're opposites. All right. So we're ready for number 125. And I'm going to read the Supreme Yoga, number 125. People like to argue and confuse others. They are indeed confused. Jay is saying, Regina, what do you see the goal to be? That question is more difficult to answer now than it would have been at one time. At one time, I would have thrown out a lot of different answers. I would have thrown out happiness or peace or clarity, being love. I believe if I'm going to use the word goal, the goal now is staying very present in the moment. That would be the goal. That goal will lead, or does lead, to an outcome which I cannot describe, I cannot define. But the goal is to be very present, very in the moment, very inward focused, always listening to my current guidance, regardless of what it's telling me to do or say or think or how to be. That's the goal. Very inward, very now. The outcome, I don't think, can be put into words. The outcome of that goal. And by the way, Jay, I've been thinking about you a lot lately. So it's nice to see you again. Nothing specific, just crossing my mind. All right, number 125 again. People like to argue and confuse others. They are indeed confused. I don't hang out a lot with the what they call the Advaita crowd, even though maybe some people perceive me as a part of that crowd now myself. But I've seen a couple of times Advaita conversations in Facebook, which to me were just, oh my goodness. You know, somebody would say something, anything, and then that whole, who said that? Who are you? Who? That whole thing starts. You know, maybe some of you have seen it. And that's what this reminds me of. People like to argue and confuse others, because that seems to be where sometimes that Advaita, it almost, you know, that Advaita almost has an attacking questioning to it, seems to go. It just confuses someone. That's all it does. Yeah, it doesn't always appear to be really helpful, you know. And this is what the Supreme Yoga is saying. People like to argue and confuse others. Those who like to argue and confuse others, are indeed confused. So let's look at number 125 in the journal. It is best. And of course, remember, although some of you I know feel that what is written here speaks to you in a way that it feels like your guidance too, and I am okay with that. I just want to clarify that this is directly my guidance. So if someone does not feel that this is their guidance, I am okay with that too. All right? This is my guidance. It is best to let each one follow his path without interference from me. Why would I correct another or state an opposing view if my view is not invited? It may be that my view is thought concept only. I need to assert my view or feel threatened. And asserting is preferred to feeling threatened. Remember that preferred state of mind? Let go of asserting. Let feeling threatened happen. What feels threatened? I'm imagining, and because I'm imagining, this may not be true. I'm imagining that everyone in our, you know, techno world at some point has made a post or said something in ACIM Gather, and someone else disagreed. Someone else told you that you were wrong. And so I'm imagining that you know what that moment of, I'm going to use the word panic, although it may not always feel like a panic, but that moment of panic feels like when there's this fear that maybe you are wrong. And you don't like that. And so maybe what you do is you quit teaching. Maybe you quit coming back. Maybe you defend. You start pulling out the course or whatever you're teaching from, and you make a case for your thought. What this is saying is let go of that asserting. We all know the teaching from A Course in Miracles. In my defenselessness, my safety lies. This is saying let go of that asserting and instead let that feeling threatened happen, that state of mind that you're trying to avoid by arguing your point, or by, maybe it doesn't feel like arguing, proving your point. That state of mind that you're trying to avoid, instead let it happen. Go ahead and feel that. And then inquire into that. What feels threatened? You see, when we defend ourselves and try to avoid this incredibly, I'm going to call it painful, vulnerable feeling, what we're doing without realizing it is that we are saying, I am this false self. I am this false self, and I need to protect it because it's what I am. But in my defenselessness, my safety lies, because my safety lies in knowing my true self. And I can only know my true self by disengaging from the idea that I am the false self. So if I let that false self feel threatened, feel painfully vulnerable, feel wrong, feel embarrassed, feel put on the spot, and then I watch it and inquire into what is feeling this, I'm disengaging from the idea that I am the false self. So defense maintains the idea I am the false self. And not defending disengages. Now, sometimes friends, or maybe not even friends, just people that we, you know, haven't even met, that we know on Facebook or whatever, will share their understanding of something, or will share what they feel is their guidance. And maybe there's something in us that feels that they are wrong. Maybe there's something in us that feels, you know, she's actually listening to fear here. She's not listening to guidance. I should point that out to her. But did she ask me to point that out to her? Did she come to me and say, I'm not sure if I'm listening to fear or guidance. Can you help me look at this? If not, then it is best not to get involved. What wants to get involved? What in me wants to get involved with my friend when that has not been requested? And tell her that she is wrong. It is best to let each one follow his path without interference from me. It is best to let each one follow his path without interference from me. Why would I correct another or state an opposing view if my view is not invited? Maybe it's because my view is thought concept only, and I need to assert my view or feel threatened. And asserting is preferred to feeling threatened. Let go of asserting. Let feeling threatened happen. What feels threatened? So, one thing that is happening for me now, which wasn't always true, is that I am standing silently by and letting my friends make their choices. I'm not coming in what before I would have perceived as a helpful way and helping them to see, because it's helpful, that they're making the wrong choices. And some of my friends have expressed concern about this. Some of my friends have said, you mean if you see me doing something wrong, you're not going to tell me? And I suppose the real answer to that is, this is not a rule. If I should feel what I know is a clear prompt to say something, I will. My real purpose is to stay in that current moment guidance. But sometimes what appears wrong isn't wrong. Sometimes what may be a temporarily painful choice actually leads to something that needed to be seen. So I don't interfere. That is my default. And if I hear a clear prompt ever from Spirit, where I know it's Spirit, I absolutely promise I will say something. But you can expect me to be more silent now than I was in past years, because this is my guidance. You're looking at it, at least for now. All right, I'm done. And I'm guessing Liz is on next because she is in the room. So you all have a wonderful time with her. I'm going to go have grilled cheese and popcorn with Danielle and Jasmine, because that's what we do on Sunday nights now. Grilled cheese and popcorn for dinner. No more cooking on Sunday nights. Followed by Once Upon a Time on television. All right. Good night, and I love you.